You remember the old joke about the Judgment Day scene where there was this just incredibly long line lined up before the judgment of God? And while everybody was waiting, at the very beginning of the line, everybody started shouting with joy. It just, and this rippled down the line. It made its way from the front of the line to the back, and finally, when it got close enough that it could be understood by the person who was observing, then he heard people shouting, jumping up and saying, "Wednesday nights don't count." That was funny, folks, in case you didn't know it. Somebody told me that you know that your time is short when people don't laugh at your jokes. I used to visit my grandmother, and she would spend the first 5 or 10 minutes chewing us out because we hadn't visited her. I hope that this sermon doesn't feel like that, but I want to be God's vehicle to tell you why He said that you should come to church. I could make a list and have on in the past of a number of reasons, a pretty large number of reasons, why I think you should come to church. But God has given a reason that I think is just really, really beyond incredible. Sometimes, and I hope you'll take this also the way that I mean it, sometimes people have asked me or Janice, what did you two do that caused all of your children to be faithful to the Lord and to be leaders in the church like they are? And let me illustrate that for you. This past Wednesday afternoon, sometime around 5 or 5:30, the phone rang and Janice answered it. And I just overheard the conversation, and it was our youngest daughter, Kendra, calling. And she had just returned from, she had finished teaching school that day, and she had returned from working out that afternoon. And she came into her apartment, and she was all sweated down and kind of, grungy, and the electricity was out. And so that meant that there was no warm water, and she felt like she couldn't take a shower. And so she called her mom to say, "Mom, do you think that I need to go to church tonight? I'm smelly. I'm grungy. My clothes, sweaty and smelly. You think that I really, really need to go tonight?" And her mom said, "Kendra, just think of how encouraging it will be to the other people who are there who realize that you came in spite of that." Now, I don't know what that means to you, but I'm just telling you that my wife's influence on our children has been incredibly powerful in accomplishing what has been accomplished in their lives. The last chapter's not written. I'm not bragging about anything. I'm not taking any credit for it. But I want to talk to you about going to church. There's an amusing scene in Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer, which perhaps, if you know anything about Mark Twain, perhaps it reflected his own attitude about church attendance. He wrote the scene that Tom had gone to Sunday school and church at the insistence of Aunt Polly. He didn't have any real desire or burning desire himself to go, and after Sunday school, Tom and his brother Sid went to the auditorium to sit under the watchful eye of Aunt Polly. And then we read the boy's description of the public worship. He said announcements were made from a list, quote, "that would stretch out to the crack of doom." And the prayer, he said, was generous in its details. And he's so familiar with the prayer that he knows it by heart, and he recognizes and resents any new additions to that prayer because it's been the same prayer every Sunday. The preacher's sermon, he says, drones on and on monotonously through an argument that's so prosy that many a head begins to nod. The services obviously bore Tom. How many of you remember Raise your hand if you remember Funeral Home Fans. How many of you remember Funeral Home Fans? That's kind of interesting. This is a Funeral Home Fan. This is pre-air conditioner for those of you young folks who are not familiar with it. And every church used to have these in the pews just like you had a songbook. And this represents something more than a fan. The wise man said a long time ago, it's not wise to say something about the good old days. And maybe it's not wise because it tells something about your memory. That we tend to see things through filters. And we talk about the good old days, and we need to be reminded of the outhouse. And we need to be reminded of things like funeral home fans. Because I can remember sitting on church pews that were not contoured as they later became. They were straight in the back and straight here, and they slanted up just a little bit so that you wouldn't slide off. And that little upward slant was really rough on a kid because your legs went to sleep as they dangled and wouldn't touch the floor. And you sat there, and there was no air conditioning, and in the summertime when there was no breeze, no cross breeze, then you could feel the sweat trickling down your ribs. Any of you been there? Boy, I've been there. And the preacher went on and on and on. Now, some things have changed, you know, but some things haven't. But I can very well remember, and I won't call his name because some of you might know him, but I can remember a sermon one time that went for 1 hour and 45 minutes. And, my mother had popped me a few times before that particular one was over. But perhaps Tom's description reminds us of similar experiences in our own lives, especially during our childhood. And so the question that I'm asking is, why go to church? Some people have attended church by habit, some because it's been expected by the family or the social circle that we're in or the community. But some people have never been a part of a church-going family. And so they really ask questions that I never was asked. Nobody ever asked me when I was growing up, do you want to go to church? So I never contemplated that very much in my life because that was not an option. But to many people, church going appears to be a custom that people maintain because they're used to an old tradition. And that's about the best that they can think of. Interestingly, of all the New Testament books, it's the book of Hebrews that addresses this question, why go to church? Passage that was read in Hebrews chapter 12, and I'd like for you to be turning there because we're going to be taking some verses from that in the next few minutes. The other books of the New Testament probably don't deal with that question because it was not a problem for those brand new Christians. They wanted to go to church. There's something about something coming out of the ground for the first time that there's a lot of excitement associated with it, isn't it? But then Monday morning comes around. And after Monday morning has come around a few times, then we settle into a routine of life. And we begin to see things through different eyes. Early Christians knew that they wanted to be present at even daily assemblies of the churches. Hebrews was written to Christians who were incredibly discouraged. They were tired. They were rethinking the commitment that they had made some years now back earlier in their life. And some of them, as a result, were making a practice of missing assemblies now. In Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25, the admonition, let us not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another, all the more as you see the day approaching. We don't know all the reasons why they were not attending church, but Hebrews gives us some insight into their situation. In chapter 5, verse 11, it says they had become sluggish in their hearing. So it wasn't as exciting. The gospel message had become less exciting than it had been earlier in their life. They were in danger of committing apostasy in chapter 3, verse 12, and chapter 6, verse 4 and 5. And in chapter 12, verse 12, it uses some really graphic illustration to denote how tired and discouraged spiritually they had become. It says they had drooping hands and weak knees. Now, that draws a pretty graphic picture if you think about it. Their hands were hanging down. Their knees were barely holding up. That draws a picture of somebody who's what? They've just gone and gone and gone until they think they can't go anymore. They're just about to drop. They're tired. And that is to whom this epistle is addressed, the people who are spiritually just tired. They have paid a price with their neighbors and their friends, and they were glad to pay that price initially, but now time has passed. And things tend to kind of settle down, don't they? And settle out, and we rethink the excitement when it's not there in the same fashion that it was at the very beginning. One of the signs of their boredom and their weariness was that they no longer attended church assemblies. Therefore, the admonition of 10:25. And so we ask ourselves, as we think about why I attend church, I would invite you to ask the question, is anything happening here? Is anything happening here? Their reason for neglecting the assembly must have been very much like our own. Perhaps they found worship too plain and too simple, hardly a match for the elaborate rituals down the street. And if you stop and think about how Judaism had developed and the ritualism that they had been accustomed to and the finery that they had been accustomed to, and then there was the pagan religions. And if you were particularly in a city like Corinth, there were lots of attractions in other religions. And so they very well might have dropped out and complained nothing is happening here because it was distressingly unspectacular. And so they quit coming. You know, it's a tragedy when we see our friends and our family drop out of attendance. It's not like dropping out of a club, you see. It's more like throwing away a precious treasure. It's like choosing a worthless trinket that we can have now rather than choosing something that is of far, far greater value that we can have tomorrow. We're like the people on the pilgrimage to the Promised Land. Wouldn't it have been a tragedy for them to stop somewhere in the desert and just say, I'm tired. This is where I'm going to live my life out right here. Rather than seeing it all the way through to the end and actually enjoying the promises and the blessings of the Promised Land. It'd be a tragedy. Permit our friends to drop out because we're family. You see, this is not just about me. This assembly. And we have a tendency to make it about me. When I leave, what did I get out of it? Did I like the way that Sonny led the songs? Did I like the preacher? Did I like the comments? What did I like or what did I not like? And we become critics. But you see, this is not just about me. We have a responsibility to make the road easier for those who are lame and those who are struggling. Paul, or the Hebrew writer, wrote in chapter 12, verse 13. We have a responsibility in verse 15 of chapter 12 to see that no one fails to obtain the grace of God because, you see, I am my brother's keeper. I am my brother's keeper, and so are you. And I have a responsibility to you and you to me. You see, the world takes away our priorities, doesn't it? And when you go for a while without coming to the assembly and without immersing yourself in God's Word, then things change in our life. Our priorities shift. We don't mean for them to. They do it subtly. We don't really recognize that they do until we've really gone far off the path. And then one day something happens that causes us to realize that we're involved in things that we never would have been involved in times past. Esau threw away his precious inheritance for a single meal in chapter 12, verse 16. And when he realized what he had done, he tried to change it. He even cried, but he couldn't change it. The decision that he had made had consequences that he was unable to change. And we might expect the author to encourage his readers when they begin to question whether or not they should go to church, that he might suggest that they return to church by suggesting that the church assembly be made more exciting, or to encourage the church leaders to match the worship to the taste of the audience or the community. But he didn't do that. Instead, he has another why of church attendance. And it's in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 18 through 29. He describes what happens every time we come to the assembly. Even when we're not moved visibly or aesthetically. Imagine these words being read to a little house church of new Christians, relatively new Christians. Just a little group that's meeting somewhere. There's nothing spectacular that goes on when they meet there. They speak to one another. They sing together. They read God's word, whatever portion of it they have available to them at that time. They're tired. They're reconsidering their commitment to Christianity. They're thinking about their former religion. And as I said, if they were in Corinth, you think just down the street that your contribution is going to buy you some time with a temple prostitute. That's a little more exciting than what they see going on around them. And these rituals that are involved in pagan religions, they're a lot more exciting. Let's read Hebrews chapter 12, beginning in verse 18. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to a voice speaking words so that those who heard it beg that no further word will be spoken to them, because they couldn't bear what was commanded. And here's what was commanded. If even an animal touches this mountain, it must be stoned. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I am trembling with fear. That paragraph is a description of Mount Sinai. And Mount Sinai represents the Old Testament covenant and the old worship. And in that temple, the worship had evolved into something that was very near and dear to the Jews' heart. There was nothing dearer to their heart than temple worship. And to come there and to be a part of those priests in their regalia as they went through all of those exercises, it was their heritage. It was the most meaningful part of their life. And now these Christians that are meeting in this little house somewhere without any of these trappings, as they're thinking back of how much it meant to them and how many generations of heritage had been a part of that, don't you know that there was something in their heart that pulled them back to that? Back to the practice of their ancestors? And pick up in verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion. This is two mountains. Both of them represent, in this case, two worship styles, if you will. Two different concepts of worship. The old one was magnificent. I mean, it involved this mountain that had smoke all over it, and there was fire coming out of it, and it was trembling. The ground was trembling, and God was speaking to the people, and there was a lot of fear and a lot of things associated with that that were just awesome. He said, you didn't come to that mountain. You came not to Sinai, but you came to Zion. You have come to Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God, where thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, the church of the firstborn, whose name are written in heaven, you've come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than Abel. They're meeting God. And whenever Christians come together in assembly, there is something that is taking place. Because it is in a dimension that we cannot see does not make it any less real, does it? It's happening. Do you believe in angels? I believe in angels. I can't see them, but because I can't see them doesn't mean they're not real. But you see, whenever I'm no longer assembling with God's people, then the things of this world, the things that I can touch and feel and smell, those are the only things that are real to me after a while. And so coming to this assembly reminds me that there is a reality that's every bit as real as what I can see and feel and touch and smell that's going on that I need to be made aware of. They stood at the base of a mountain that they dared not touch, but the writer informs us that we don't assemble at Sinai. We assemble at Zion. And thousands upon thousands upon thousands of angels are in joyful assembly here with us today. We're joining a heavenly host that are having this great, joyful assembly this morning. God Himself is here. Why do you think He said, where two or three are gathered together in my name, what? I'm right there in the middle of you. I'm right there in the middle of you. The spirits of righteous men made perfect are here. That means those people who've gone before. That means Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and all of those faithful persons who've gone before us. They're here. We're in assembly with them. Jesus is here. The sprinkled blood that made us holy and the basis of our access to God is all around. You see what God's trying to do here in this passage? He's trying to impress you. And I'm asking you this morning, are you impressed? Does it impress you what's going on when we assemble? Now tell me one more time why you can't attend every assembly of God's people. What is it that's more important? I've forgotten. What is it? As William Temple said, all of life ought to be worship. But we know quite well that there's no chance it will be worship unless we have times when we worship and nothing else. What I'm saying to you is I do believe that life is worship. And I know that some people consider that to be controversial. But I believe that all of life is worship. But I believe that there is exclusive worship that takes place on the first day of the week assembly. And when God's people are assembled, that you can't get anywhere else. And I don't believe that everyday life worship takes the place of this assembly. And when God's people are together. If we don't have special times of worship, we lose our perspective on life and our sense of values. We begin to think that the only things that are really real are the things that we can touch. And we live in a society that's lost its sense of God and knowing anything beyond this material existence. And even though as you look around you this morning, it may not be real impressive from this world standpoint, when we meet together with our brothers and our sisters and with God and with Christ and with all the saints who've gone before us and with angels, and we're reminded through singing and praying and the Lord's Supper and studying and fellowship that we receive strength to keep our lives on focus for the true goals that God has set before us. We receive a message of hope and encouragement from outside this world. And God knows we need it. Because we assembled here as failed parents and failed sons and daughters and husbands and wives. A message of forgiveness. A message of hope, a message of righteousness. And we associate with people that we wouldn't otherwise associate with. God's people, our real family. Alvin Toffler's book, Future Shock, describes an unsettling effect of living in a world where nothing is stable. Rapid changes in technology means that we may have to learn new job skills two or maybe three times in our lifetime. The mobility of our society involves us and our neighbors in making so many moves that we're never able to have acquaintances for very long periods of time. Beliefs and moral standards are in a constant state of flux and change. Today's standard, you can be sure of one thing, it won't be the same standard of tomorrow. And Toffler says that such changes can be destructive unless we find stability zones to give security to our lives. God's provided that for us as Christians, hasn't he? Beyond anything else that the world offers, and that's right here, it's what's taking place right here. It's when we sing together and we pray together and we're assembling with the host of heaven. An incredible thing. An incredible privilege and blessing. There are many, many areas around us, many changes that we cannot prevent, but we have one area of our life that provides us this sense of security, this connection with God that you can't get anywhere else. You can only get it in the assembly. Why go to church? Hebrews 12, beginning in verse 26 or 25. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them out of earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven? At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he's promised, one more time, I will shake not only the earth, but also heaven. Those words indicate the removing of what can be shaken. That's created things. So that what cannot be shaken may remain. He's saying this world and everything about it is going to be gone. God's going to shake it. It's going to be gone. But there's going to be one single thing that remains out of all of this universe, out of all time. The church. That's all. Everything else is transient. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and worship God acceptably with reverence and awe. For our God is a consuming fire. Why should I go to church? Did God impress you with what's happening when we come here together? I hope he did. Let's stand and sing.